Our phones, watches, and wearables promise insight, knowledge, and freedom, but what they really deliver is information overload, confusion, and servitude. That is a statement from the new book, Unplugged, that you will hear about in this week's podcast episode. Welcome to the Ardella Training Podcast, where we bridge gaps in strength, performance, and injury prevention. My name is Scott Ardella. I'm your host, and welcome to episode number 217. And in this week's episode, you'll hear from Brian McKenzie and Dr. Andy Galpin. And these guys are phenomenal. And you're going to hear about their new book, Unplugged, that literally just came out. Now, let me tell you about Brian and Andy, and then I'll talk a little bit about the interview session and the book this week, and then we're going to get right into it as usual. Now, I'm sure that you're very familiar with Brian McKenzie, who is a world-renowned strength and conditioning expert and the author of the best-selling New York Times book, Unbreakable Runner. He is the founder of the training program Power Speed Endurance and is the co-founder of the Complete Fitness Lifestyle System, XPT Life. Dr. Andy Galpin is a professor of kinesiology at the Center for Sport Performance at California State University, Fullerton. He has a PhD in human bioenergetics and is the founder and director of the Biochemistry and Molecular Exercise Laboratory. And again, this is a session I think that you'll really enjoy, loaded with great content. And I have to tell you that this interview came together really fast. As a matter of fact, I really wish that I had an opportunity to read the entire book prior to the interview, because there's so many great nuggets in the book. And I literally just got the book the other day. As you know, if you're a listener to the show, I talk about this all the time, but I love to read the physical books, the hard copy books. While I had a PDF version of the book, I was able to scan through it prior to the interview to give me some kind of fundamental understanding of what the book was about. I love this book, this new book by Victory Belt Publications. And by the way, all the products by Victory Belt are really great products. They're great books. Like, physically, they're great books. They're visually really put together well. A lot of pictures and things in their books, and they're really an outstanding publisher. And I love all the books by Victory Belt, which certainly includes a lot of Kelly Starrett's work, of course. So I highly recommend the book, and I'm reading it right now, getting into it. Spent a lot of time actually reading it last night, and it is fantastic. And that opening quote there that I mentioned in the beginning was something that came out of the first pages of the book. So anyway, now just to tell you about fitness technology, my story, I'm really not into the fitness technology. I'm not a gadget guy when it comes to fitness. Although there is one tool that I do use quite a bit. We talk about that in the interview. And if you don't catch it, I'll actually talk about it at the end of the session. And I'll tell you what I like about this one specific tool that I do use quite a bit. So there's a lot of content in this session. I'm super stoked to have Brian McKenzie on the show. This is the first time I've talked to Brian. I'm a huge fan of his work, and certainly he's done just some amazing things in the industry and is doing amazing things in the industry. And then I came across Dr. Andy Galpin recently, found out about him. I think he's a brilliant guy and super passionate, and just really, really excited to have them both join me on the show. So you're going to hear right out of the gate, is this book anti-technology? We talk about the importance of stress. We're going to talk about how to unplug, specific strategies for that. And we even discuss genetic testing and its relevance to fitness and performance. So a lot of great content. Again, I hope you enjoy the session. You can find this episode online at ardellatraining.com/RT217. Again, ardellatraining.com/RT217. And you have all of the links about the things that we talk about in the show notes for the episode. So let's jump into this week's interview this week. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll come back at the end and wrap things up for this week's episode. Enjoy. All right, guys, Dr. Andy Galpin and Brian McKenzie are joining the show this week, and they are the co-authors, along with Phil White, of the new book titled Unplugged: Evolve from Technology to Upgrade Your Fitness, Performance, and Consciousness. I'm really excited about your book. This book really caught my attention in social media recently, and I've had a quick opportunity to kind of preview some of the content. It looks amazing, and I'm excited to read it myself. Let's jump right in and talk about the new book. And I guess the first question is, what is the big message behind the book Unplugged? And is this a anti-technology book?
Andy?
Yeah, well, I was going to give Brian that since it was his original idea in the first place, but...
Well, okay. I'll jump on it, and then I'll let the good doctor jump in.
All right.
So, one, this is not anti-technology. The facts are is that technology is going nowhere, and we don't actually have really much of a choice but to either engage in it or fall behind. So a large aspect of this book is primarily about the possibilities of what we can do with technology. When in any situation with anything, if we become dependent on that thing, we then get caught something that doesn't allow us to use our DNA or our abilities the way that we were actually designed. And so we start shutting things down. And the human body is unique in that it gets rid of what it doesn't use and it improves what is used. So the less we actually have to understand how we react, and let me use the situation that I just had in the last year where I got to swim with some sharks, and it was a lot of sharks. There were probably 30 or 40. And we were told to remain calm, behave as though you're a part of the environment. If you decide that you can't handle that and you start freaking, we're going to need to get you out of the water. And a couple of buddies that were with me actually did start to kind of freak out. And the moment that they freaked out, the sharks went from a very calm, welcoming state to a very anxious, driven, predatorial state. And, you know, it's interesting because we have the ability to walk into a room and understand people and moods and who's got good energy, who's got bad energy, who's in a good mood, bad mood, what doesn't seem right. Yet we're really, unfortunately, moving to a world where we're being told what's right and what's wrong. And that's not how we operate. So I think the premise of this book is to use the idea of what technology is helping us get back to more of this natural or kind of caveman coded DNA that we actually have.
Yeah. And I'll add on to that, that, you know, the basic idea, like Brian said, most importantly, it's we're not going advocating in this book, like, well, ditch technology, go live in the woods. You know, your iPhone's bad for you. Like, sorry, that stuff's been played. It's been said, it's been covered by other people. And there may be some truth there, but we need to evolve to have a better conversation about our relationship with technology, because like no one's going to do that. It's just not realistic. So the big premise, another big premise of the book is if you look at your physiology and how your body operates, that most technologies that are revolved around fitness and performance and health are very, very unilateral in their measurement. So they take one physiological measure and they tell you what to do because of that. The most advanced ones are still maybe looking at a couple of dozen or a couple of hundred measures, but that's nothing remotely close to the amount of information that your body is integrating simultaneously as an entire organism, as a system. So what we want to do is, one, help the people realize that, look, just because your app told you to go take a day off or told you, you know, hey, maybe go work out today, like that might be some useful information there, but you should not take that as gospel. You've got to be able to take the information, because information is helpful. We can make better decisions sometimes with information, but we can't treat the information as insight, as infallible, as this is what I do. It's just another piece of information. So that's really a big message of the book.
I didn't really mean to kind of throw out there the anti-technology, but I kind of wanted to make that point clear that it's not anti-technology and more along the lines of what you just said, it's how to minimize the dependence on technology and maximize our natural state. Is that fair to say?
Brian has a bunch of stuff actually in there that actually we go through it a lot of how to use different technologies and how they can be helpful. In fact, we try as best we can to provide a framework that's universal. So regardless of the technology you'd like, here are the things that generally technology can help with, and here are the things and how it becomes problematic. So that's really the point.
How did the book develop? Because this is a very interesting topic. I mean, I'm assuming that with the, you know, the growth of technology today, you know, some of the stats that you mentioned where Americans bought 19.7 million wearables, which is a 67% increase from the start of 2015. What's the downside to the technology and the growth of the technology in health and performance?
Technology is advancing at a rate that we cannot. So we're literally something that's increasing at a rate that our physiology and our ability as a biological system does not have the ability to adapt that quickly. And so when you have that happening, you have a problem. So a lot of this has to do, like a lot of the work we're talking about is, hey, as fast as this is going, how do we actually connect it to what we're doing? So the ability to kind of connect that. So before the robots and the AI actually start, you know, making all the decisions for us, we better start to really look at this as we understand it's coming and it's going to be here, but we better start understanding what it's to be used for, not that we're going to be used.
Yeah. And, you know, like it's funny because almost daily now, Brian and I will see some new technology come out. We laughed about halfway through the book. Something came out that said, you know, and I think one of the jokes in the book we talked about is, what if you had a device on your wrist that told you when to drink water? And then about halfway through reading the book, that device apparently came out on the market. Oh, we're wow. Like, this is exactly what we're talking about. It's not that big a deal right now because technology is kind of laughable compared to where it's going to be. But if you don't build the infrastructure in your own life and your behaviors and your patterns now, the technology that's going to hit you in 10 or 15 or 20 years, you're going to be gone. You're going to be so swollen and sunk in that hole that you won't be able to come back out of it. And so really it's about setting up a lifestyle and other habits where you can survive that when it hits you and you're not literally waiting for your watch to ding and go, okay, drink a water. Oh, ding, go to the bathroom. Oh, my, right. my new app says take a breath. Like this is just, it's a terrible place we're going to be in. And from a physiological perspective, which is really my official background, if we think about the human species or any biological entity as we see it here on Earth, what survived through the millennia have been the things that respond to various stressors. And what I specifically mean by that is you have some very easy and popular examples right now are you have proteins and enzymes and molecules and certain DNA that respond to a wide plethora of stresses. And if those things are not actually stressed or turned on or engaged, they go away, right? This is how the body works. It upregulates, downregulates based on the state. Well, those have a huge function in regulating the entire body. So as an example, imagine you had 100, we'll just make numbers easy, 100 proteins in your body. That was it. Right. And say 5 of them function to respond to cold. Well, one of the responses to that cold is to clean up dead or half-functioning cells. Well, if those 5 never get worked on, they go away, they become dormant. That function never, ever happens. And now it's quite funny because, like I was joking recently at a conference, that we spent, you know, whatever it is, 2 million years of human sapien or Homo sapien existence or however old we are, doing every single thing we can to reduce stress. So to reduce everything that can be stressed in our life.
Right.
And right now in this time in the world, we actually did it. Like we won. But now the problem is sort of like, oh man, maybe that shouldn't have been the goal. Because we just are now starting to realize how that's a physiological problem.
There's good and bad stress, right? So how do people recognize the difference?
That's an easy thing.
Okay.
One, if you're inactive most of the day, you don't know how to deal with stress properly. That's just a fact. Movement is actually kind of our basis for buffering stress. But anything, including moving, can be done or overdone. So when we become highly inactive or we're sitting most of the day and doing things, the stress tends to go to the head. So this is where we have self-manifested diseases like depression, anxiety, and all these things that literally we did not see, you know, hundreds of years ago. These things were rarely seen in indigenous peoples, things like that. That's thinking about that. We need to understand that there's a certain dosing of stress that we all should be having. But it's the rebounding effect of that. So the easiest thing becomes, how well do you sleep? How well do you recover? Can you get up the next day and do what you did the day before? And so when that can't happen, we then turn to something to tell us, oh, you're ready to go, or you're not ready to go. And so that there's nothing wrong with that, but the problem starts to sit in, am I reliant on that telling me when I can do something versus actually feeling when I'm now capable or in a place to do something?
Yeah, and Brian, let me clarify a point too. Brian's not at all advocating or suggesting that all mental health or depression is 100% self-induced. No.
So,
but a portion, some portion of it is. And I'll actually go a little bit further, Scott, that I think it's almost unhelpful to even consider worrying about what type of stress is good or bad. Stress is stress.
Right.
Like, it all matters, right? And so where we have tried to place this in the book is to say, well, let's have a context. And if you provide yourself with a framework of context regarding stress, it no longer becomes good or bad. It all becomes the same thing. And then we can detach ourselves mentally from the situation, like hence the word consciousness in the book, and actually look at it categorically as opposed to looking at it abstractly. So whether or not I'm hungry today, or I'm overworked, or I'm underslept, or whatever your stress is, I can now detach from the situation, look at it for what it is, and then say, okay, I need to make a change, or I don't, or this is what's happening to me. And so you have a lot more control of the issue. I mean, not total control, but at least you have some consciousness of it, which completely sabotages its effect. Not totally, but in a huge portion of it. So it's a problem now, but it's going to be unbelievably uncontrollable when AI takes over, because you're not going to have anything to do with these processes. And a large portion of your day and the freedom you have now is going to be completely gone. So that consciousness has to be developed now.
So let's go back to the two things that Brian mentioned, which was sleep and recovery. Is there ever a role for technology, in your opinion, to evaluate sleep and recovery?
100%. I've used them and I've got them.
Okay.
I don't use them.
Yeah.
Because here's what inevitably happens. How good of sleep did I get last night? I gotta check it. Or am I going to? I'm not going to bed exactly when this thing's telling me to go to bed. You're now setting up another stressor, just like Andy was alluding to.
Yeah.
So if you can detach yourself from that and learn from it and understand what good sleep feels like and what bad sleep feels like, then you can alter your reality. And this is where the idea of technology comes in. Okay, maybe I need some help at understanding this, because I'm a stress case and I don't sleep. So you get the technology and you start to learn how to mitigate some of the stressors in your life. I mean, the real fact is here is that people are actually like working too much and not de-stressing enough, right? So you take a look at your dogs or animals in general. They're able to go from a highly sympathetic tone to a parasympathetic tone in moments. I mean, they could be going after an animal to kill it, and both animals, either way, are going to go and downregulate in the next minute or two. And, you know, like my dog's barking right now, right? Like, he'll be asleep here in the next minute. Yeah. Yet you and I and everybody else is going to sit there and fret over why I'm barking and what I barked at and why I didn't post on social media, or why she posted something on social media. Right.
A good example of that is, we'll just deal with sleep, since Brian or whoever brought it up. Okay, so maybe you're not even aware, you have no idea how much sleep is influencing your life, or if you're getting enough, or if it's good quality, and you're trying to figure this up. And so you get some technology that helps aid in that. Great. Like, that's potentially useful. And then you maybe start tracking it, and you start noticing, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that A, B, or C affected me so much. And I realize that when I do that, when I watch TV or when I answer emails right before I go to bed or whatever it is for you, I don't get it as much good quality sleep, even though maybe the hours are the same. Well, that's an appropriate use of technology, but that's only going to take you so far, because then it becomes self-diagnostic in the terms of, like Brian said, you'll maybe answer one email and go, oh no, now I'm not going to get good sleep tonight because I answered that email or something. You cause an effect that wasn't going to happen anyways.
Right.
So that's a baseline, say freshman level use of the technology. What we want to do is get you to a senior level, which says, okay, now can you take that and can you start matching it with feelings? And can you start predicting or out-predicting the technology and saying, okay, I realize these three things were triggers, but how about halfway through the day, the night before, did you start to realize, boy, I'm lit up today stress-wise, mentally stress-wise. I'm going to have to do some things to wind down extra hard tonight because I know I'm not going to sleep well. That's higher level of consciousness. And the technology helped you get there. It helped you get calibrated, but it doesn't control you and telling you when you wake up the next morning, it says, hey, you slept great and you still feel terrible. The feeling should have a place in that equation as well, not to sick the technology.
What are the dangers with technology? So as you're talking about this, I'm just thinking, you know, how does someone recognize when they're becoming too dependent on the technology versus their consciousness, their awareness, their intuition?
Well, I think we all probably are. I don't think there's any of us that aren't too far down the road at this point, because this is not a problem we've really had to address. Now, it's actually funny because if you go back, pick your date, there's amazing quotes from the 1800s that I've brought up before and found that are complaining about people getting too soft and technology dependent in the 1880s. And
right.
This plumbing stuff is going to kill our society and all this stuff. So I think we're all too technology dependent and it's only going to get worse. So I don't think that's even, I don't mean like this, but I don't think it's even a question worth asking or worrying about, because we're already too far. Let's just get better.
So something that I saw in your book, and again, I have not read the entire book, but I was fortunate to scan through it. And you talked about technology being addicting. That's what I'm trying to figure out, is how does someone recognize when they're addicted to a technology?
Well, pay attention to any people whose job is to work behind any of these major corporations. Facebook's the easy one to pick on, but you're out of your mind if you don't think major technology companies don't have a host of behavioral scientists behind them identifying exactly what makes you addicted and want to go back and check your app. I mean, I'm guilty of sin about checking my phone all day, and I'm sure Brian is too, and although he may be better at it now as I am, but like they're coming after you, and you have to realize that like this is not an accident, and it's only going to get worse and worse and worse, that they are going to prey upon. I kind of don't mean that pejoratively, but they're going to prey upon what it is for you to be a human and these natural instincts. And so you have to be conscious of that or you're doomed.
Yeah. So just to kind of piggyback on that is, if you don't think that the same people responsible for the tobacco companies and alcohol companies that were doing their work to make their products sexy, to blow them up and get them out in the world, is not going to happen. This is exactly what is happening. This is always going to happen. And the idea is that we think we're great at predicting the future, but we are terrible at predicting the future. And the only way we can predict anything is by our past behavior. And our past behavior is literally repeating itself every single time we progress. So alcohol, tobacco, for instance, what did they do? They used manipulation through marketing, all of this stuff. We now have cases of people, and I'm not suggesting that this is the only reason, but we now have cases of people in their 20s with Parkinson's disease. Why do you think that is? You think it has anything to do with the amount of dopamine and the amount of technology people are sitting on in front of these things? Because this is what the neurologists that I'm talking to are actually saying.
On my show, The Body of Knowledge, we trace this whole thing too back in terms of from the fitness and health industry. So why it went from what it used to be in the early 1900s to how it switched and transitioned to bodybuilding and how that took over. And you've got two competing factors going on. You have one, you having some autonomy in what you want or choose, right? This is the problem with technology. And I'm sure you're familiar with the echo chamber or the silo effect, right?
Yes.
In terms of confirmation bias, right? You're only seeing things pop up on your newsfeed that you already like or agree with. And so we're just in a circle of echo or circle of silo where you're never seeing new information. But even stepping back further to what Brian was talking about, you don't even realize that what you think you want has been programmed. So not only are you not getting to choose what you want, but you don't even realize that they chose for you what you think you want. And now we've got all kinds of other problems, and we didn't really get into it in our book too much because we're not philosophers.
Yeah,
I would encourage you to talk about to Sam Harris or follow his stuff. But the ethics of technology moving forward, it's the biggest question I think we have on the planet, because this stuff is about to take over our consciousness entirely.
Let me ask you this. What technology is, I guess, necessary or essential for peak performance?
I honestly think that you could pick any one thing, and as long as you understood how to use it. The fact is look, I don't know. I probably have I've got one of the most eclectic mixes of professional athletes I've ever worked that I know of, my friends that I've worked with, from whether it's wrestlers and MMA athletes to endurance athletes to action sports or extreme sports, people who are shooting, so accuracy, you've got stuff like that. It's just very eclectic, right?
Right.
And it really does not come down to the technology they're using, ever.
Okay.
It never does. It comes down to the individual and the motivation of what it is they are trying to accomplish. Granted, I think the one thing that does stick out is the fact that they have somebody programming them something or telling them something to do, which the vehicle of the internet has allowed this largely to occur.
Yeah, I think the Kenyans have shown us that example pretty well, right, with running. It doesn't take a whole lot of technology. And I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the new Nike 2-hour marathon thing, where they took the guy, the whole goal was to finally break the 2-hour marathon, and they designed a whole new shoe. They put a whole team of support runners behind one guy. They had a whole team of technology people. They had a pace car, like a physical car that they ran, that they had drove on the track in front of him. That was an electric car, so it wouldn't put out emissions, so that he knew exactly what his numbers are. He could see it in front of him. They could pace him and everything. And he still couldn't break the 2-hour marathon.
And he could draft.
And he could draft, right? So they let him draft off the people and all this stuff. Now, yeah, they probably will do it because they'll attempt it again, and they almost got it. But the question really is, are we talking peak performance? Or are we talking peak physiological performance? Because he improved his quote-unquote running time. But I think Epstein made this argument pretty clear that I don't know if he actually, if you put him on a dirt track and take all technology away from him and you put him on a dirt track compared to people 40 years ago, I'm not sure he's running that much faster.
Yeah. So take Andre Degrassi being taken right before the Olympics. They had him outfitted in Jesse Owens' exact setup, not only the track, but his start, the timing system, his shoes, the gear, and he couldn't run faster than Jesse Owens.
I think that the best technology to really answer your question to peak performance is like what Brian said, where it's probably the one thing that helps the one individual person get through their one major roadblock. In that case, technology could be helpful. And the problem with that is, though, if you've got a track team of seven athletes, that probably means seven different technologies for all seven of them.
Yeah. So maybe that was a bad question to ask. It was very, very broadly asked. But I guess what I was looking for there was, maybe are there specific tools and resources and apps And I guess there are. It's just going to be dependent on the athlete and on the goal.
Yeah. Yeah. So right? I definitely think if you are somebody who's looking to understand your performance, there's nothing wrong with starting with a heart rate monitor. I've probably got plenty of them, right? I don't use them. I rarely use them. I think a pulse oximeter is another good thing just to understand oxygen concentration levels and heart rate. This all can play a role in recovery and understanding recovery and intensity. But getting glued to part of this book, the reason this book really happened for me was because of a client who actually couldn't let go of his heart rate monitor. And he told me that his number, if he went over 166, he's going to blow while we're on a run. And I looked at him and I said, if you're at 165, you're going to blow at 166 and you're having a conversation with me, then you're not understanding what that tool is for. You've actually progressed yourself. You're actually able to handle more and go faster than you think. So you've got to understand these variables. I think those are two really good ones. I don't see, I mean, equipment wise, it's great to have a lot of strength training equipment. This is technology. This is hacking, you know, right. Just hacking fitness.
I would say that any kind of motion capture stuff, and that could be as simple as a cell phone, that you can take videos with, or even simpler, like we talk about in the book, a mirror. This is all technology we're using to improve, in this case, movement quality. Like, I don't realize my hips are in that position. All right. My back is straight and it's not. And then you show them a video and it's very easy to realize that. So, I mean, those are all like all those very common ones are very good. But I've been on the, and Brian probably has too, but I've been on the backside of several companies that make, I'll be vague here, but various fitness technologies.
Right.
And I'm telling you, as a buyer that just shelled out $300 or $600 for these things, you would be shocked of how little goes into creating their algorithms so that the number comes out. Huh. I mean, let's take the heart rate monitor. Like, how do you know that when that says 165 on your watch, that actually means your heart rate is 165? Because that's not an actual measurement.
That's a great question. Right,
that the measurement of something that's put into an algorithm, that's into an equation that spits out a number. That's very, 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 very different. So there is some error in there. And if you think every heart rate monitor company uses the exact same algorithm, you're out of your mind.
What is the error rate for something like that? Do you know?
Huge. Yeah. Massive. I mean, really? I was just telling Brian a few weeks ago, I was at the American College of Sports Medicine National Conference. And I don't remember the numbers because, you know, I wasn't tracking it for any particular reason. I was just kind of chuckling. But I probably saw 40 or more different studies that are presented from around the world. And what was it, Brian? Something like half of them showed that they were pretty decent accuracy-wise, and then half of them showed they were terrible.
Yeah. I just kept getting text messages of how crazy it is that we're reliant on this stuff.
They seem to be particularly inaccurate at higher intensities, which is like, okay, great. So cool. You got my walking heart rate. Awesome.
Oh, that's a little scary.
Yeah. So, and now let's take that. And that's the easy example because there's a ton of money. I mean, you got billions of dollars in heart rate monitors. Now let's go to something more complicated, whatever it happens to be, something that's newer or truly innovative. Something where you can put a wristband on your watch and it can tell you your sweat rate. And you really think that thing is accurate? I mean, Fitbit's still getting sued left and right because a Fitbit that's worth how many billions can't get the damn numbers right.
Right, right.
They don't work. Research is already out. They don't work. But people are still putting them on and still wearing them. So the essence of the book is, okay, well, if you're actually going to do this, here, let's not – have you completely go dumb on this and understand why you're using it.
Yeah. So the common things like these companies will hide behind the difference between reliability and validity. And what they'll say is like, well, yes, they're not valid. In other words, they're not measuring what they actually tell you they're measuring.
Yeah.
But they are reliable. So say it says I measured you at 150 and you're really at 140. Well, that's not valid, but
right.
if it says 140 every time, when I'm at 150 every time, it is reliable. And they hide behind that. And so, I mean, the chapter in the book on this section is, okay, fine. Well, there's problems with that, but let's even set that aside. Let's give you that part of it. Well, okay, how about then we use that as the tool like only like it's reliable and not like it's valid. So we learn to understand what that means, but we can't tie ourselves to it because we admitted right there that it was a faulty measure. So how can I – what are the benefits of using reliable invalid data? And there are some. There's a ton. And so we outline those, and then what are the pitfalls? And like Brian said, let's not go dumb on these smart technologies.
That's pretty alarming. I didn't realize that. I do want to go back to something that one of you mentioned a couple minutes ago around assessing movement and looking at some of the video kind of movement software apps and things. Do you guys think that is a good thing? That is a good part of technology today?
I think you need now – looking to a AI or a computer to tell you what movement is good or bad, I do not think is a good thing. I think a coach using something like, let's just say, a coach's eye or something that allows the coach to slowly move through it.
That's what I'm talking about. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
That is absolutely 100%, you know, a viable useful tool. And the reason I believe in that is because I think mechanics and position sits at the top of all principles of performance.
Right.
Because when mechanics and position go out the door, everything logically is starting to shut down.
Yeah. And I won't tell you the story here. I'm going to make you to buy the book to read it. But Brian had a beautiful story about our mutual friend, Kelly Starrett, and his experience with some of these software programs. And it's in there. And Kelly wrote a little part about it in there. So it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, I'll let that as a teaser.
Yeah. And one of the more used things in the world, and even a guy like Kelly was using it. So, you know, it's perfectly fine. And I get it. Like, cause we're all trying to figure out how to hack or be better at something. Right. But right. The fact is it's not going to be something that's going to get you there. It's you that's going to get you there.
Yeah.
You just need to understand that you've got these things called senses that actually work at a very high, profound level.
Right.
I mean, Brian, you've been screaming this for a decade or more, but like pain is a good example.
Yep.
This is the best screening tool you could have is pain or thirst or, well, I mean, you name it, performance went down. That's telling you something.
Yeah.
Don't let that stupid watch tell you what it told you.
Yeah. So
you figure it out and then you'll really solve your problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so if I remember from the book, you talked about the four best predictors of mortality that have remained unchanged in the last 50 years.
Well, it really just depends on kind of what population, and not all studies have examined all of them, so it's hard to label them as, you know, the top four, but the ones that continually pop up as predictors are your maximal leg strength, the total amount of lean body mass you have, so the total amount of muscle mass, you can think of it that way. How strong your grip is, so your grip strength, and VO2 max. So those and some rare combinations and a few others. But it's funny because now that that VO2 max one in particular has gotten so popular, a bunch of scientists and teams have jumped on board and started looking at other what guys in our realm would call performance markers. It's funny how that word is used, right? Like performance is performance. Whether we're talking about performing on a soccer field or performing in life, they're now acknowledging it. That is performance. But anyways, so I'm actually interested to see what comes up because I guarantee you more things like this, in particular foot speed, leg power. These are all starting to pop up now as, man, these are also really, really strong, significant predictors of clinical prognosis as well as mortality because we realize that, like, look, if we're going to stay alive, this is about maximal human performance. And, you know, we better be doing something to address that.
So most of these are simple measurements, you know, grip strength, for example.
Yes.
Is that surprising?
Not if you really, like, critically think about that.
No.
Got to be able to hold things.
Yeah.
You can't hold them. You can't get up off a couch. You can't get up off the toilet. You can't get up off the ground. There's leg strength, lean body mass. That's been indicative of you know, our species from the get go. You didn't see overweight, obese. Like, we're the first time in history. We're now in self-created disease.
Right.
We don't have, like, the only thing killing us is self-manifested disease, not disease that was not self-created.
Yeah. And to temper that a little bit, I mean, there's a difference between causation and correlation here.
Sure.
So a lot of these are correlations. And so it's not to say that, hey, if I improve my grip strength by 5%, I'll live 5% longer. That's not how it works. But in that case in particular, since that one is the least direct influence on longevity, you know, VO2 max, leg strength, those have very direct implications. Grip strength seems to confuse people, but really what it is it is a direct indicator of overall health and strength.
Yes.
So if we look at the normal population of, say, 300 million Americans, those that have a higher grip strength are probably likely to also have higher leg strength. And they're also likely probably have more muscle and things like that. So it is just the reason why they actually added grip strength to the equation is just because, as you mentioned, it is extremely easy to administer.
Yes.
So if we start talking about making changes in societies, you're not dragging a leg press in a metabolic cart into every physician's office so that every person who walks in gets tested.
Right. Yeah.
So while those are probably better measures, you're not doing that. But a hand grip dynamometer is tiny and it takes 2 seconds and then takes no training at all. It could at least give you a starting place to say, like, oh, hey, you're pretty good. Don't worry about it. Or you're terrible. We need to now do follow-up studies and get you on a VO2 max or a stress test or something. So it's just, I think, a much, much, much more appropriate screening tool for actual health than looking at their blood pressure or your cholesterol levels or some other nonsense.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think what you said in the beginning there is that correlation does not mean causation. And again, that is really important to understand. I'm assuming that these are probably all like observational type studies. So here's a question I really wanted to ask you guys. And this is really a fascinating area for me personally in trying to understand more. And you talked about it a little bit in the book, but it's the topic of genetic testing. So what do we know about this and how do we use this information in our training? So, you know, if we know that we have more fast twitch muscle fibers, does that change anything?
Or you just opened up a can of worms. Don't you have like a PhD in that fast twitch thing?
Yeah, that's pretty much what I do have a PhD in.
All right, well, let's hear it.
This is actually, I think, a really funny and interesting one because I'll give you a quick answer is,
okay.
Well, that stuff is exciting. We are absolutely nowhere even remotely close to being accurate with fiber or genetic-based training prescriptions. Having said that, I mean, this is a great example of our book. So Brian had a client, and I won't divulge the name unless he wants to, but that got the genetic testing done, found out the person, according to this document, is more likely to respond to aerobic training, switched up, added much more aerobic training, and had a huge positive response. But it's funny because, again, I can tell you those things are wildly inaccurate and do not do that based on that information. It's not scientifically validated at all. But that doesn't mean you can't have some things. So in that particular case, Brian used the technology. It gave him some insight because he'd been working with that particular client for a long time. It gave him the push to change the training a little bit. But Brian's coaching experience with this person is what really allowed him to make that change and make it successful. I don't know if you want to add to that at all, Brian. But.
Yeah, I think that there, if you're willing. So, you know, I was early on. I got my hands on a lot of this on the genetic testing stuff. I've done the testing like I think with three different companies at this point.
Okay.
They're all basically doing the same thing. They're all using the same tests.
Hey, Brian, actually, do you mind if I ask what you got it done with three different companies? Were the results consistent?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Yeah.
Most of it, for the most part, yes. For the minor part, no. Okay. But here's the tricky thing is that they're all testing the same things, but some of them are actually adding different things or removing things and making it so they have some uniqueness to them. By and large, most of the information is useless because here, and let me like really try not to go down the rabbit hole here, but sure. My parents, and I'll bet your parents and Andy's parents, they don't really care to follow a lot of the stuff we're doing. They've built their lives and they've done their things. And most of the people that I run into who really are set in their ways are never going to change. And so when you actually present people with information that shows them what they should actually be doing versus what they have been doing, there's a very difficult process in actually changing that. And so, but the thing is we already know that you can hack the human genome. You can actually change your own genetics by expressing other genes and suppressing other ones. So if you're predisposed to aerobic training, yet you're doing a lot of anaerobic training, you're making what people are hearing is, oh, you're not maximizing yourself. No, that's not necessarily true.
Right.
You're just not expressing what you could be really good at as much, but you're also going to have to expose this anaerobic side to things, right? Or your power side is what they use, the power endurance or the power aerobic or endurance side of things in the genetic testing versus more of the aerobic response. I've got a guy who I've worked with for over a decade who is one of the top ultramarathoners in the world, and he was a high level aerobic responder. Then he had the genetic testing done. He's like, oh, shocking, I'm an aerobic responder. And we're like, yeah, he still doesn't go out and do more than 21 mile runs because he knows what the hell it's going to do to him. If he goes and does repetitive 20 mile runs, it's going to wear at him. So it doesn't give you like the go ahead to just go and do, I get to go run every day, all day long. It's not necessarily what the answer is. Right. It's really taking a real look at everything. And it's kind of like they do the same thing with diets. And it's very difficult for people to change what it is they're used to doing.
Since Brian got me fired up there, three things. Okay. One, again, so he's not misinterpreted there.
Yep.
You can't change the genome. So your DNA is not going to change at all. It is what it is. But the way that it is manifested, like he alluded to after that, right, is accurate, right? So that's epigenetics, the way they're expressed. So
sure.
Put it this way. You know, just because you've got a full deck of cards, we all have a certain deck of cards. You only get to play five at a time in poker.
Right.
So you can't change what your hand is, the whole deck of cards, but you can drastically change how they're played. All right. So that is a very important distinction there. But number two, specifically with this type of DNA testing and telling you some sort of prescription, you've got two major problems with this field. Problem number one is we still have, although we've sequenced the genome, so we know what all genes are in the human genome, we don't have any clue what a vast majority of them, quote unquote, do. So we might have an idea that it is related to, say, muscle growth, or it is related to mitochondrial biogenesis or something, but that may be based on literally one or two studies done in cell culture from one lab somewhere. And then you want to take that and then all of a sudden develop training prescriptions? It's unbelievable. These are not well-established genetic markers, not even close. I think people would be shocked to know that the vast, vast, vast majority of these markers have never been studied in humans and never been studied, certainly under the context of exercise and performance and strength versus aerobic. I mean, we're nowhere near getting that stuff done. And then the bigger problem with all of it, because in theory that could be overcome, you know, with technology, with supercomputers and AI, they might have that figured out in the next 10 or 15 years. They won't, but they could. But let me give you all that. Let's say they do. The bigger problem with all that is assuming that genetics and the body in particular work like coding software, or this analogy that they work like you're a machine, right? So if I go into your car, or if I go into computer programming and I delete one part, so I delete one sentence, the whole program stops working, right? If I take your axle out of your car, the car doesn't work. That's not how physiology works, though. Physiology is smart enough to go, oh, that we lost a line of coding there. Let me replace it with something else. So I will take a spare tire. Maybe I'll take the crowbar in the back and I'll wig that around so that it functions like an axle. it's not an axle. So when you measure it, it'll still show me no axle.
Right.
But I figured out to get that same place with using a part that wasn't designed, quote unquote, for that. So that's always going to be the fundamental problem with these things is they're not unilinear. Like they don't have one purpose, and that purpose can easily be changed. And we're not even sure that that purpose is the same from person to person.
So again, without going down the rabbit hole and to kind of close,
well, we already did, so
to close this topic off, does genetic testing, does that change anything in the way you train? Yes or no?
Did not for me. I had already figured it out.
Okay.
I knew I made massive responses to more intense and more powerful work versus the longer stuff. But I also knew I had to do the work in the longer stuff as well in order to get used to it.
See, that's the bigger point is I say no because, okay, let's come back and say Brian is a power responder, right? And you know, he's been saying this stuff and showing these things on his social and his other platforms for years in his books.
Right.
Okay, great. If Brian did nothing but train that way, he would fall completely. He'd be terrible because he lacked so bad the other stuff now.
Yep.
So it fundamentally still doesn't tell you what to do because it hasn't asked the big question of, well, number one, what are you training for? And number two, like how bad is the other side? It's not just black and white, on or off. It's a spectrum, right?
Right.
So if the other part falls completely in the tanks, you're done for.
Got it. I mean, it's a really interesting topic to me. We could probably spend a lot more time discussing.
Yeah, I think the most important use for it right now is what Brian was talking about earlier with the example of our parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I have done this, and I put this in the book with many professional athletes that basically don't want to listen to my coaching eye or their coach's recommendations for training. All right. Just like the parents' example, right? They're set in their ways. They're not going to change. Fine. Well, sometimes when you bring in PowerFit technologies, whether it be genetic testing, sometimes or not, or other things, those can be so convincing that is the impetus that's needed for them to change. So if you had an athlete who wasn't listening and you kept saying, we need to do this more, we need to change this more, and they wouldn't do it, and then you got genetic testing and it agreed with you, the combination of those things might be enough to push that athlete and go, oh, okay, maybe let's take a shot at it. Right. So I think there might be some use there, but really it's not the technology that helped. It was just a convincing matter. So can you really give the genetic testing that much credit, or is it them being excited about new technology to credit? But that I think is the appropriate use for those things now.
Okay. Last question about that. And then we'll shift gears here. Would you guys recommend genetic testing for the audience if they have not done that? I've done it myself.
If they have the money, sure. If they want to spend the money on something more useful, then don't.
Fair enough. I mean, if you want to find out, how likely you are to have red hair or something, when you're 35 and already have red hair, then it's great.
Look, I'm far more interested in trying to understand my own physiology and how I operate.
Sure, sure.
By doing my own testing so that people like Andy go, that's interesting. Like doing enough work to understand something catches the eye of somebody else. And it's like, hey, this change happened when I did this. And like, I'm more into not having something tell me that's happening versus feeling that thing happening. So I think there's far more for people to really spend their money on. But if they have the money, there's no reason why you can't go get it done and go, huh. I guarantee you, you're going to find things that you already knew, though.
Okay. All right.
So as a performance training tool, I don't recommend it. For other health or habit relating issues, perhaps. But for training issues, not something I'm super concerned with.
Okay. All right. Let's turn back to the book. And let me ask you, are there a couple of simple key habits that you can recommend to the audience to disconnect? If they – maybe they're – I don't want to say hooked on technology, but they're using technology. What are some things that they can consider to disconnect a little bit more?
Get out in nature at least for, an hour a day. Like truly just get out there and go be in nature with no other technology.
And do what? Do you walk, run, walk, play?
Run,
yeah.
Play, observe, be aware. be aware. You will start to pick up a good friend of mine, Stephen Kotler, spends a third of his day in nature every day because of the world that we're inside. We're in front of screens. We're on our phones. We're emailing. We're texting, doing all these things. But get out in nature. Not, you're going to stimulate senses, things that you're hardwired like. Like, for instance, my dogs lived in Southern California. We now live in Central Oregon, in the middle of nowhere. And in the course of 6 months, my dogs have learned how to hunt again. They couldn't hunt anything when they were here. It is now murder central for chipmunks and squirrels. They've learned how to pack. They've learned how to instigate. They've learned how to manipulate. They've learned how to prey. I mean, it's crazy what they've learned to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to be it just has to be a central priority in your day or at least week. And the tip I would give, honestly, is start slow. You know, not all of us are going to be able to move from 40 years in Huntington Beach to Central Oregon, right? So, okay, like, don't take that as a way of saying, okay, then to hell with it, I'm just not going to do anything. So do what's possible for you. So if that means once a week you get in out into nature for 1 hour, well, great, start there.
Yeah.
Wherever it is you have to start and get moving, right? And whether that means start taking your phone calls on headsets when you're outside instead of in your building. Okay, that's a start. Now, when you're out there, let's do some breathing drills and notice how different it is and how your senses get heightened and how you smell things differently after some breathing drills. Or look up, for God's sake, when you're walking. Like, and notice the trees around you, which I didn't do for months at a time in my new house. And I realized, like, oh my gosh, every time I'm walking, I'm listening to a podcast or something, which I thought was a good behavior, till I realized I'm still plugged in. Like, I'm not unplugging here. So I got to ditch that stuff from time to time and just be out there, even though I'm still in an urban environment. And I send Brian a hate text every day because I'm so jealous of where he lives now. I'm from the country, so this is living in the city stuff is killing me. But you know, like the whether it's just that little bit of thing saying, okay, I'm going to go walk my dogs through my urban environment, and I'm going to notice the plants around, and I'll notice the grass, and I'll breathe, and I'll look around, and I'll just be more aware of what's happening. I think all of those are fine, and some of those may have sound terrible for some people and some might sound better for others, and great. That's the point, is to give you a ton of options. Which one lands for you? Now go do it.
Look, even in New York City, they've got Central Park. So you know, there's somewhere to get to. It's going to get you connected back to your own senses somewhere. Just start small and let that kind of guide you.
Yeah. Another thing I would say is, and this is the end of the book when we get into all the training programs and the prescriptions and all that stuff, but this sounds terrible, but I promise you it pays out. In fact, a couple years ago or something, I remember Brian made an Instagram post, and I think it was a picture of him about to get into an ice bucket, and it was 7 a.m. or something. And he's like, you know, getting into an ice bucket at 7 a.m. never sounds good to me. Like, I don't wake up excited to do that. I'm dreading it. I'm putting it off. I'm finding stuff to do.
Yeah.
But it always pays off.
Wow.
So if you're not ready for an ice bucket at 7 a.m, fine, but find some type of suffering, hunger, thirst, whatever it happens to be, and really start to pay attention to your senses. When you get a little bit hungry or a little bit tired or a little bit hot, or, you know, God forbid, a little bit cold.
Yeah.
That helps you start to realize, like, my gosh, I've become so desensitized in the world I'm in. When I actually truly stimulate some of these senses, boy, things just start firing off.
And you recommend this every day?
Now you have to read the book to see the recommendation.
Okay. Solitude. I saw that was mentioned in the book. I wanted to ask each of you, do you have daily practices specific to that where you really shut it down and just go into quiet time each day?
Well, I don't think Brian has an option anymore based on where he lives. I think all day it's right.
Yeah. Easier for I've had to adjust to how dark it gets. I've had to adjust to, well, actually the light cycle right now is pretty trippy because it comes lights on, like sun's up at 4:30. It's starting to come up. Like it's light at 4:30 in the morning and it doesn't get dark till almost 10 PM.
Oh, wow.
But when it gets dark in the summer months, even in the winter, it is pitch black. which is something that took 2 weeks to adjust to that, especially in winter.
Yeah.
Winter up here is crazy, but I really think that, you know, I try, like, my schedule only allows for like things to happen between like 10 and 2 PM. And that's from like this kind of a standpoint, meetings, consults, podcasts, et cetera.
Right.
And then I'm on the verge or on the ends of those things is where I get a lot of the, you know, computer work, emails, et cetera, you know, social media stuff done. And then it's really a shutdown, from dinner on. You know, that's what we literally try to do is dinner on. There's just no technology. It's just, you know, there might be a little TV, but like, yeah. You know, I typically, if I turn on the TV or even start reading a book, I fall asleep. So
that's great.
Which that's great. Is not the norm, has not been the norm in the past. And I think that's the thing is that I'm trying to like point out that I have had sleep issues. I have had technology problems. I have had these things and I have been able to really get into the nuts and bolts of the reality of that and change it. And I'm doing, and I feel better and I'm better because of that.
Yeah. Brian and I are both, and don't let me speak for you, Brian, but, are both fairly comfortable and generally prefer solitude, especially for recovery. So that's not one that we struggle with personally. I find solitude every single day because that's oftentimes what I'm seeking, in a lot of respects, especially again for recovery. So if I'm tired, if I'm fatigued, I don't want to go to a party. I don't want to interact. I don't want to be on social media. When I'm tired and fatigued, I want to be away.
Right.
I realize some people are the exact opposite. And I think those folks are the ones that maybe need a structured solitude plan where it's 30 minutes a day of meditation, or if it's a walk every day or whatever it is, it can be. Those people probably need it. But I generally don't go a day without some solitude. So that's the one that I just let happen naturally.
So solitude for you then is really just kind of shutting down from technology and just quiet time. I mean, is it reading or what specifically?
That doesn't do it for me. Okay. Reading, information seeking generally gets me very, very excited.
Okay.
I get too riled up when I read, when I engage and things like that. So a bunch of different practices for me. That can do it. A lot of times it's exercise or training. A lot of times it's being outside with our two dogs or a bevy of different things. Sometimes I can feel that same recovery, honestly, when it's just Natasha and I.
Right.
Since I feel good in that space, surely it is ice time. that definitely does it. When we get in the ice tub and do the different ice things that we do or cold things we do. So I can get it a lot of different ways.
All right. So I don't want to keep you guys too much longer. I have a couple more quick questions, but final thoughts on Unplugged. I feel like this is really just the tip of the iceberg as far as this book goes. It's incredibly content rich. And I had a huge list of questions here. I didn't get to the majority of them. So that really speaks to a lot of the content that's in this book. So what else should the audience know about this book as we get ready to wrap it up?
What I'll say is this, like we did, we spent a lot of the time on here doing what I would call complaining and whining and talking about the problem, but it is really in its nature, a solutions based book. So there are training programs in it. There are prescriptions for how to go about these things, whether you've never done any breathing work or if you've never done any fasting before, how to get started, where you should strive to get to. And we gave you kind of calibrated you to what's normal, what's good, what's average, that type of stuff. So that is all in there. If you're like, whoa, this sounds intense, but I've never done anything like this. I don't know where to start. That's all in there.
If you felt like kind of, we were just bashing the technology, which we kind of, you know, in essence, we're kind of, we do that a tad, but the fact is all you have to do is really read between that. And, you know, like in us talking about these things that we're doing to decompress or get away from the technology, there was actually a day full of technology in there. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's there, but it's, you know, this is beyond just having times to set things down. Like, I mean, I use cooking, I use gardening, I use building things as mediums to get away from the technology and get immersed in other things to not only distract me, but to create creativity, to get more creativity going that allows the work that I am actually doing to become even broader. And that's, you know, it's simple things, man. It's simple things to like literally get involved in that are a part of you being involved in it, not it, you know, controlling you.
Yeah, this is definitely not a, if you're looking for the book that has, hey, here are the 10 keys to help you not check your phone so much, you're going to be disappointed. That's not what we did in the book.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you guys are both readers because there's a lot of book references and author references in the book. And this is a question I ask every guest that comes on the show, even multiple guests. But is there a book that you could recommend to the audience, a book, maybe the book that's impacted you the most so far, or a book that you've read recently that's made a big difference?
The one I would say right now that I think is, and maybe it doesn't do the same things that you just referenced, but the one I'm recommending the most right now is Jocko's Extreme Ownership book.
Okay.
Just because it's, if you don't know who Jocko Willink is, you should find out. His message is very simple and it's very easy to integrate. And I feel like it's one of those things where if you just understand what extreme ownership means, that's all you need to get from the whole book.
Yeah.
Because it's so effective and it actually is saying a lot of things that we're saying, which is to basically say like, you need to take control of your own stuff. And his book is really more about leadership and stuff, but it really, it's the same message we're trying to say, which is to really be a leader of your own self and your own physiology rather than outsourcing everything and then blaming your continual weight gain or your lack of weight loss on the fact that the app wasn't done well, or that it was the app, like, that's all leadership stuff, whether you're leading other people or you're leading yourself. That's a part of what we want to accomplish in the book, is to give you some tools about how to do that.
That's great. And I actually had a recent guest recommend that book as well for the reasons that you just mentioned, kind of taking responsibility and accountability.
Yeah. Brian, I mean, it's nothing particularly new, of course, but then again, nothing is. You know, so it's not a knock against him, but he just, I think it's very easy for the average person to understand the message, unlike some other books, which are a bit more complex.
Brian?
Yeah. Mine's kind of a dual one because it's a two book series.
Oh, okay.
I largely think getting an understanding of the biggest influence happening on me right now is by this guy. His name's Yuval Harari. And he's a historian of all people. And he wrote a book called Sapiens, and that kind of transformed the way that I started thinking about a lot of the things I do in human performance. And then his second book is Homo Deus. And it is about where we're headed. And this book works really well with Homo Deus, but you got to go through Sapiens first, understand the history of Homo sapien and a real history, like not just somebody's opinion of what they felt like we did or sticking to one part of what we did. It's a real large look at what's happened to our species. And, you know, I've kind of peppered this conversation with some of the stuff that's going on with what we're doing. You know, it paints a picture of possibilities that our future holds. And there, because we can't predict the future, which is something we talked about and we're at, but our behavior is very, very historical. And how we treat our own species and other species is the only indicator of how we move forward. And I really think this holds true value in what we do, not only in the work with performance, because human performance is only my medium for helping how the human race kind of evolves and treats itself. And I think Andy's in the same boat with what he's doing. And this is why we get along real well, because we have this way of doing it. And I think these two books really spell that out and work incredibly well with how we've laid out Unplugged.
Wow. That's thank you for sharing that. They sound very interesting. Not familiar with those books at all. So I'll definitely take a look. Guys, where's the best place to find you online? Social media,
Twitter @BrianMcKenzie, Instagram, at I Am Unscared or at Power Speed Endurance, and website is powerspeedendurance.com.
The book Unplugged is up on Amazon right now. We've got a website, athleteunplugged.com. Our Unplugged book on Facebook and Twitter. I think that's the social, all that. But people nowadays, Google Unplugged book, Brian McKenzie. It'll come up. You'll find all that stuff. You can find my social at DR, like Dr. Andy Galpin. And then my website is just my name, andygalpin.com.
Excellent. Thank you, guys. And the final question is, what is the big takeaway action for the audience after hearing the interview today, besides checking out the book, of course?
Get out into nature.
Perfect. Andy?
Get stressed.
Get stressed. Awesome. But of course, understand what you mean there, the type of stress,
well,
right?
Yeah, totally. Obviously, the difference between like, oh, I'm so stressed at work all the time, and like, when's the last time you've really been physiologically stressed? And then I should say, more importantly, pay attention to what you're feeling and really spend time in that thought of what you're feeling when you think you're starving to death, or when you're having a crappy attitude and you can't think straight because your blood sugar is low because you haven't eaten 6 hours. Really? let's challenge that. I don't think you're going to die.
Thank you so much for coming on. Wish you the best success with your book, and thank you for all the great work that you're both doing in the industry. This has been a pleasure.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, guys. Well, there you have it. Another book to add to your reading list. That book would be Unplugged. I highly recommend it. I am early into it, as I mentioned in the interview, and it is outstanding so far. I will certainly come back and provide feedback about the book if you would like. Just be sure to reach out to me and remind me on social media, and I'll certainly share my feedback about the book when I'm done reading it. So the tool I use that I mentioned in the beginning of the session is Coach's Eye. Coach's Eye. Now, that is a movement assessment app. I think it's about $5 in the iTunes store, but it is a tool that I use all the time, and it helps to analyze movement. It doesn't replace what we're already looking at, but it adds some components, some digital components that I like to look at when analyzing movement and performance. So that app is Coach's Eye. I'm a big fan of that specific application. So that's a wrap for this week's episode, guys. Make sure to become part of the community. You will find some free training resources at ardellatraining.com/join. I hope that you become part of the community, and I'll certainly have great things to share with you. You can also find me on Instagram at ardellatraining. That's it for this week. I'll see you next week. Stay tuned for great things coming, and we'll talk again soon. Take care.